This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
After her reading, Margaret Avison was silent and everybody else was silent. There was a question asked of her, which she would wish to answer now.
If the person that asked it is here about the thing on the board.
Yes.
Is the person that asked back here?
16.
And if they're not, I won't bother. Oh, please do it anyway.
16 wants public.
Yes.
Yeah.
First one?
No, it's a
timeship's game. No, actually, see, what it was that when Margaret first came in, when we all first came in, we were discussing that. That she would answer the question, but then we got hung up. Which we should have had this meeting where because people flow to market.
It's awful. It's almost as bad as it was after the reading, which I couldn't quite hear the question or cope with it because I thought I was finished. But I like the structure of always when there's something that is good, it trembles towards something that is dangerous. You're always in the area of danger. And that's why I put going all out, going for broke, all those things, you're aiming at the area of the good. And I just defined one of the goods and the danger. The one good is the single-mindedness and the danger that you're on the edge of and topple into very easily is monomania. And monomania differs from the other in the ways I've tried to describe. It's a kind of you've got your two poles there. Down here, you're mediocre or nearly dead. And you start up either side, and you get to a point where sparks are always sort of leaping. And the single-mindedness has a focus within the complete circle of what is living, so that the single-mindedness is like the eye, and it can shift and swing all the time and is very flexible, a maximum flexibility. The monomania is the very opposite, and it's right next door to it, so you're always sliding almost into it. And it's, like Heraclitus is the single-minded, and anger in painting is the monomaniac, where you, in order to keep the move that is being alive out of things, you try to freeze it and freeze yourself and keep the focus that way. And that's what the thing on the board was supposed to be saying. And how it relates to what I was reading, maybe it was just an extra poem, which I hadn't written.
You worked that out with Opie, sitting in the room, that's something that you didn't do.
No, I no doubt worked that with Olson over 20 years in somewhere.
The other day, trying to generalize about the
Buddha,
I seemed to come to the idea that it didn't matter. I'm using mostly in social work. And it didn't matter whether something in a poem was a central question, prison or a thing or a place or an event was beautiful or ugly. You don't ask that question about a person, whether it's lived, whether it is. And the word we kept using was the word there, whether the idea that the poem being there and that the thing in the poem being there, in other words, that it having presence. And then the psychology of the poetics, I think, which was also involved with it, is the fact that the poem will be there and the figure within the poem will be there, and the poet is also there and meets the experience. And I wondered what you thought of the relation between this and Gestalt therapy, which seems very much a psychology of how to become there.
But I don't want to get...
Well, I don't know enough about Gestalt therapy to answer this question.
I want to be here, you know. Well, that's curious. Robert has a poem in which he describes how does the mind organize those sounds leading us away from the thing. Remember in the Venice poem where he has the whole context of sight, where you're standing literally, you're standing looking, and then he says, how does that mind organize those sounds leading us away from that thing? In other words, taking the sight and using it as a vocabulary of reference, and then organizing verbal constructs that lead one away from the context of seeing into the whole complexity of understanding or feeling or talking about this occasion. So, how do we define Gestalt therapy? I mean, Gestalt is a kind of.
Well, Gestalt therapy is interested in bringing
the whole body, the whole physiology.
Bringing the whole person into contact with the environment. In fact, defining the person as the Gestalt, or as a figure ground relation of the person and the environment.
That's wild, isn't it?
And talking about life as continual destruction and recreativity of this relationship, of this boundary between the organism and the environment, and the person and the environment. And the thing that really, I think, is so terrific is not the theory so much, but the experiments, whether you're doing it through a Gestalt therapist or in itself. It's a kind of Western yogi.
Yeah, it is.
I mean,
experiments
of awareness.
I think that's why Zen, by the way, comes in so sharply and so clearly in the 50s. Because this is also the time when Reich, for example, was most focused, or comes into focus in the
40s. Everything is becoming as dead as possible. Certain things are trying to realign.
Not even real. It's when I remember reading a very moving book, perhaps a very incompetent book, but by a Russian psychologist transliterated actually into Harvard, named Petram Sorokin, who lectured. We were talking about lectures of Boulez, for example. Pierre Boulez, the composer, gave at Harvard this spring, having been invited by him for a semester. And the problem of his English, he delivered his lectures in English, and he made the effort, in effect, to translate his thought from French into English. He spoke English very poorly, so few people could really understand it. But Sorokin had the same problem with his classes. He spoke Russian primarily and spoke English poorly, so that people taking his classes basically, let's say, couldn't understand what he was talking about. Well, they could certainly feel what he was talking about. And he speaks at that time of the whole dislocation of identity in terms of all the claims that are made upon that identity for value, e.g. The businessman was his example, the man who names the context of his home and his wife and children, in which he has one system of values, and then goes to business, in which he is forced to have another system of values.
Right.
And goes, so that the whole translation of his person into these various guises or uses is a constant dilemma, because he cannot feel singly, or he cannot feel wholly, let's say, in any one of these contexts. In the business context, in other words, he's engaged in a highly competitive activity, which is constantly qualifying other people in terms of what he can literally, you know, how he can use them in this sense. In his family relationships, he's giving, let's say, all that he can. In his business relationships, he's taking all that he can. Sorokin, he thought altruism would answer all this. In other words, a simple return to what actually we've been talking about. Al says we all approach these by different ways, the ways of our own nature, but we're all, in effect, moving to the same sense of wanting. We want to be loved. We want love. You know, any man who denies that he wants to be loved, any woman, you know, that he wants love as a possibility in his life is almost unspeakable. Unspeakable, unsayable. So that the Gestalt theory was simply an attempt to locate, medically or psychologically, as it happened, the person beyond verbal constructs. In other words, that's what we talked in the hall there yesterday, and Reich, you see, was very interested in this and wanted to get beyond the context of simple verbal locations. In other words, I remember one friend telling me of being analyzed by a Reich and a psychologist, and he had this appointment with the psychologist at 11, and he got up in the morning, washed his face and all, and ordered himself. Said, I feel fine and I'm ready now to go. And he walked into the analyst's office, which was probably a quiet enough room, and the man looked at him and said, why do you feel what you do? In other words, literally, and suddenly he's crying. Because, or that would go back to Warren's story, Warren Tolman's story, visiting his son Ken and seeing the habit of we have as when boys in the room recognize this, the habit we have as North American men of not showing our feelings because it's a sign of unmanliness, so that we're trained very early not to cry and not to not to exhibit our feelings. And Warren spoke of his son as they visited him, and the whole place was contorted, trying not to cry at the moment when most reasonably he should cry, when all of his feelings were wanted this egress, he wanted to cry. That's all of his feelings were saying cry, and all of his habits of training were saying don't cry, and this contortion was 9-year-old boy's face, 8-year-old boy's face. It's very painful. Teach him how to cry. Or let him cry. Create a context in which he can cry. Don't talk to him if you're asking him. I mean, don't simply address him with words. Address him with words. That address. I want to stop talking. I'm unable to stop, so I call someone to help me stop. Shut it off.
Don't address him with words. So, in my class a couple of days ago, as a result of a conversation with Waylon over lunch, the students and I were trying to work out a set of words applicable to each of the teachers here, each of us.
Let's not call ourselves teachers.
Okay.
We went through all that.
Well, I changed it and said each of us here. Mm. Which were our key words to indicate a definite experience of being here in the universe, or being in our bodies, or being in person, or being located in form, or being in a place. I don't know if that works out, but it might eliminate a lot of confusion in our own minds in terms of, as far as terminology, and also possibly in your mind during the conversations of the last week. My own idea or feeling was that we all were driving or feeling toward the same feeling, but using a good deal of different terminology because of the different backgrounds we had and the different illusions we carried with it. So we wound up putting on the wall, for myself, the word eternity, for Robert, the word form or place, for Olson, the word energy, for Duncan, the word field, for Denise.
What?
Was natural harmony.
Natural harmony.
Thank you.
God bless our home.
What is your key word, Margaret? Or is there one?
It's your game.
Yeah, but I'm not well educated to be able to
key
word. Well, I don't want to go through that again.
Go for broke.
Get up and put it on the wall. But does that idea make sense at all?
Sameness.
Is that your
keyword? Sameness is repetition.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're him talking about gestalt. Gestalt is nothing but aspect.
What?
Same thing. Yeah, but I'm not... Everything is the finger pointing at the ground. Mm-hmm. The aspect of God, something leaping out of his ass or his mouth, or something pointing at the ground.
Uh-huh.
They went a little farther. They didn't have the humanism that the Gestalt had. You see, and they
what a poverty of context.
Values and whatnot, because they built these idols from the mud and the blood, you see, and it's a horrible thing.
Well, for example,
if it was Cortez, was right.
Oh, he was.
But he should have masked his rightness in something else.
We were talking about logistics in that class, the sense of Grant's shift that occurs in the Civil War, where the whole concept of contest of this order becomes the shift into logistics, e.g. men become raw material, along with whatever other means are available, where you plot the contest of a war simply in terms of what material is available, get there first for the most, is his principle. And so men then relate to that principle. In other words, he expends like 10,000 men at Shiloh, and the actual literal context of being human in that battle is terrible. E.g., 5,000, I think, just by the second day of growth, and literally are crouched under a riverbank, you know, terrified, green troops. And they pick up rifles on that field that has as many as 7 to 10 unexploded charges in them, maybe even from the muzzle loaders. Literally. I mean, they didn't literally, so that you're only using, you know, you're only using the machine to, at that point to contest the contents of the machine. Or later in, well, let's not talk about the Civil War, but my sense is, you see, where the reality has become so extensive verbally or in the senses of identity that the we have to return to our bodies, as he is saying, by the agency of this order of health, e.g. psychologists or whatever, we have to be literally returned and allowed ourselves. And if you have any of you I know who have children, know that this is not necessary. It's not as simplistic. We would say he's childish, or he's, you know, he acting like child. And the beauty of being able to be child, in the sense of to be in your body, and I have the sense that I'm one with my skin. To have, and the only other time I heard that said by any human being is by a 7-year-old boy. You see, said I'm in my skin. God.
He uses the word child.
I don't mean this in any sentimental sense. I mean it literally as the whole, the way the structure of feeling that that age of growth.
It seems that,
I'll
put it in another thing, as a person grows older,
they come against
he gets, that body. He gets to a more primitive childness, which is not the same as the born child who is merely a boy.
Right.
And goes through the making, and then he breaks, and then he's remade again.
Right.
Age.
I remember.
Seems to me we keep getting off on such very vague questions, which don't really concern everybody, and which are the sort of conversations that really should be being had by groups of two people. And that, for instance, now Alan raised sort of tried to start a hare, and nobody really picks up on the things that are started. For instance, let's suppose that he's correct, that these are key words for each of us, eternity, form, place, energy, natural harmony, and go for broke, which you didn't suggest anything else, so I put down go for broke. Well, in what way, why are we talking about these things here? Not just between us here, but why are we talking publicly about these things? Are these concepts of any use to anybody else? I mean, what are we doing here discussing these things? In what way are any of these ideas useful to you? Are they useful? Yes.
As I looked at the words, it seemed to me that some words, although Alan knew what they were, all the words, each one was, that these mean somewhat the same for each of us. Each word emphasizes a different part of this sameness that you're all after. Mm-hmm. And that's what interests me, the difference. I wonder if we could discuss how.
Yes, not the not the sameness, but the differences are what is interesting to discuss.
I would say that one thing, as each person here who writes a poem, writes their good poem, and as everybody else does, everybody else's possibility of good poem increases somehow.
Yeah.
I think so. So everybody's word matters.
Everyone.
Well, the only thing I was concerned was that nobody, I don't want to inflict anybody with my virus, so to speak, or with my language, finally. In fact, I'd like to get rid of it myself. I'd like to get rid of my eternity.
As a
word, as a concept, is something that I've been playing with, is something that I've been hanging on to, something that I haven't entered. But I'm just whirling around in my head as a, you know, an assertion of direction for me, without ever getting there. Oh, and also I'm afraid if I start talking about eternity all the time, explaining my big theory of eternity, pretty soon, some poor student who digs me will be walking around playing with that word in his head. Same, I have the fear that some will get hung up on Christian's terminology and not see what the terminology is pointing to.
For example?
Or as I got hung up on Bob's form, an idea, though I got hung up on it in a negative way for a long time because I just simply didn't know what he meant by it and thought it had something to do with the idea of form that I learned at Columbia University, where form meant a like dead imitation of poetic forms. I didn't realize by form he meant his body, or was pointing to his body. Is that not right?
Absolutely.
Which, you know, when Bob and I first got here, we got into a long conversation, finally had a rapport, when I realized that the language he was using, he was talking about the same thing that I had intended to talk about when I was using my language, which was quite imprecise.
Well, you said that when Olson uses the term form, he's talking about his body. When I'm talking about form, I'm not talking about my body. I'm talking about the body of the...
That's what's so confusing. See, we're all using the words in different ways.
I'm talking about the body of the thing regarded, of the sequence of perceptions that the poem is arising out of. Not my body.
Let me locate the dilemma briefly, as it was, you know, one time in Chicago, well, I don't have to give the context of the comment, but briefly, a man had given a reading at a university in the Middle West, and someone in the audience had been moved by the next to the last poem he read. I mean, this is a student audience, like they say, who's fresh from the whole context of his teaching. And after the reading, this person walked up and said, would you mind if I asked you a question about the next to the last poem you read? And the man was reasonably pleased, as I would be, after reading. And he said, of course. And he said, was that a real poem, or did you just make it up yourself? That locates for me the whole dilemma that we're moving. And this is not so funny. E.G., yesterday, one of you was talking and showed me what to me was an extraordinarily moving context of words. I mean, I'm beyond the, not beyond, but I am bewildered as to what literally is a poem. I only know a poem as I write it. You know, I don't even know it then in an explicit or extensible sense. I know what I feel, that's all. And he was... because literally he's in the whole question of his own understanding, or very much in the context of the grid of his own feelings, was bewildered to know whether or not this was a poem. He said, I know what it means, in a sense, literally, I know what it means to me, but is it enough? In other words, and then I think of another joke I'm called for, in which there is a large sluggish pool of oil in the bucket, and undifferentiated moments, a piece of wood comes up above the sludge, and it has written on E-N-U-F, and then it disappears again. So, you know, that's Papa, of a sort. Crankcase. No, we're wrong. But anyhow, you see, what we're doing, how shall we measure what we do, you see? That's, I think, what we're circling around. We can use all that is. All it is, so that there's no reason to be embarrassed, let's say, facing any instance of feeling that occurs in any context of language that you can literally go in the library and get out. But equally, there's no necessity, per se, not to feel what you feel explicitly. E.g., you have no reason to be ashamed, or to be worried, or to be defensive about that which you feel in words. If you feel something in words, why should you not feel it in words? So that the form, to my sense, is an issue of that possibility, literally.
So the form then is the way it came out in words.
Yeah, the context, the feeling that was given. I mean, I think everything is given in a sense.
And what was your idea of form, or your use of form?
Oh, my use of form is that the form of the poem.
All New England had it.
Is the form of the content, and I would change the word extension in the famous sentence. Form is never more than the extension of content. To form is never more than the revelation of content. Sometimes it's an incomplete revelation because the attention has been removed from the content before the form is fully revealed. But I don't like the word extension, and it's been bugging me for years, and I couldn't understand why. About 2 weeks ago, I realized that, to me, extension really suggests overextension. It means exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to.
The point is, what did he mean when he said extension?
Remember what Baudelaire said? Remember that in the letters? There's a cook of Baudelaire, not Baudelaire, it's Flaubert's letter.
Oh.
It's simply trying to state a context in which the issue of some occasion is the means by which form occurs, as opposed to a putting on form like a coat, you know.
Well, I don't think I quite follow what you're saying, but
well, see, now form, well, like
putting
a coat
on
has form.
What?
Doesn't it?
What has form?
A coat.
Everything has form.
There's
even those things which appear formless really
chaos is a verb.
Have inscape. There's an inscape of everything, but it isn't always apparent, and it can become apparent through an act of faithful attention and exploration.
It can be revealed.
Yeah. And that's what I think poets are doing. They're revealing the form that is already there.
Well, I have the hymns of St. Gerion are concerned with that distinction with between form and shape. And it's worked out already.
The mind is shapeless.
Gertrude Stein says, how do you do? How do you like what you do? And that's
all
that is
true. You mean what you see, or do you see what you mean?
Well, that's all that's money.
That's good, too.
I'm wondering about this for a couple of questions now. What about the Olympic sign? I mean, not about, what about the 20th century sign. What about the Olympic
sign? Well, I think that the sonnet arose as a direct expression of a certain kind of an inscape of perception which was shared by many people. I think it has psychological and historical origins which could really be which can really be explored and understood. I don't know enough about history to explain them, but I know that they're there, the reason why in the day when people really could write sonnets, when it was valid to write sonnets, it was valid for many people to use that same form, because they really were sharing an experience which had that form. Because I think, in my experience, perceptions tend to come in units, and that is why some poems are broken up into stanzas which are all the way through, possibly three lines or four lines. It's not because you wrote a three-line stanza and then you decided to write all the rest of the poem in three-line stanzas, which of course is all wrong, but it really is genuinely that the within the larger unit of the poem, of that particular poem, the clusters of realizations came in units of similar length, and I think that accounts
can
for the sonnet.
Can I go in and speak on the sonnet too? I think that I agree with what you say about it belonging like that at that depth. It's some conversation started with you, and history, when you have the conversation with the sonnet, can become small enough that you want to answer back, the same as you go to a party and you discover they don't speak anything but, suppose it's Italian, and you know just enough Italian to make the attempt for the sake of it. And if you know ahead of time, you swat up what you do know and maybe listening to some records to free whatever you've got. And so the young writer can possibly only have a conversation with the sonnet part of history of poetry if he's willing to join it at that point. And then he comes to a point when he takes his authority in his time and finds what his time is shaped like, and then... So, but there's no... Is there anything damaging?
You can write poetry like a machine.
It's like the automobile. Mr. Jury, they invented, we say, the automobile. Here's his thing, some people took it and made cash out of it. It made this terrible thing that you see running around the street. The Rolls Royce people took it and made a beautiful object out of it. A Bugatti and made it beautiful. Personal.
You're saying it's a machine, but that isn't what Denise said.
No, and that's, of course it isn't what Denise said. I'd say what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And, you know,
So here is this thing. And there's a thing of taking this thing, which is better than doing it in France and in Europe in various ways. Now, some people were able to manage being big time and really be a pawn regarding the something, even the thing being there. And then, of course, other people were sonnet, and there are wonderful statistics on the number of sonnets that were written just in England between, what, 15 so and so and 16 so and so. There were something like 30, 75 million sonnets. Not to mention those that exist in cotton manuscript, 87, 77, 80. So there you are. All right. And listen, the best place to check out on this and test out your sensibility and the whole point of what this is about is one book. There's a beautiful book called The Elizabethan Lyric, and it was written and compiled by Norman Cole, A.B.L.T., from the original manuscript and the original printing.
Oh. It's in paperback now.
It's in paperback, like Kathy Franklin. It's also, I forget who did the original.
I think the original edition is out of print. Well, the sonnet became a popular form, really. It became like the ballad. I mean, it became a sort of usable mode, but then it ceased to be a usable mode, but people went on using it anyway.
I think there's a difference between a form and a machine. I don't understand.
A machine is a form.
It's a metaphor.
No, machine is what is not unpredictably living and unpredictably subject to
the
things.
The sonnet becomes unpredictably living when a person, when a real guy with a real vision takes it over and makes a poem.
Well, what I'm saying is that you can't. One of the things I'm saying is that you can't.
UNIVAC begins to get unpredictable. And
oh no, I because it would involve a contradiction. Actually, I was going
to
say.
Doesn't
matter. Forget it.
In the order of Genesis, the poet is prior to the poem. Well, what does the system allow? E.g., you're talking about physiology or senses of context in that reference. It's literally what can the quote machine unquote do?
No, it isn't. Unless the thought and the at least the first shoot of the form, I mean, like the first shoot of a plant coming out of the ground, are simultaneous. You're not going to really have a poem. You're going to have one of those things where you're, like we said the other day, you are translating thoughts into words, which, if a person has a certain level of competence, may turn out as something not altogether without value. But it's not a real poem.
Well, I agree in the sense that if you say, that word, and the thought you call is connected, is the same. They are one.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the feeling and the word are one, in other words, when one speaks with feeling, or when the word is connected with the body organically, when in other words it doesn't allow, it isn't just a lot of verbal spinning on the top of the head, then there is a simultaneity of occurrence. The thought doesn't necessarily have to come in front of it. In other words, when you're...
You see, you don't know what you think until you see what you do.
That's
what I meant.
The poem has
never worked. But it's not an extension.
Well,
extension is when you take something and you...
Because we're lying all the time, most of the time.
Well, it's like catching a
letter.
What?
He lifted this out of the letter.
Oh. Yes, but it's become kind of the law, you know. It's written in everybody. It's been written in my notebook since for God knows how many years. And I've always had an uneasy feeling about it. And it must be written in everybody's notebook. And it really needs... That law needs revision.
He says, with this important corollary, that the content, that it's the content really underhand. If there's no occasion other than what is, as it's literally now. And you have a book called Here and Now. That's the point is, as Alan was saying the other morning when he suddenly broke in, We can't lose ourselves in species. No, I hereby renounce extension is the useful word in that context.
Not enough, apparently. For sale, that was good news if not yet sold.
I never understood it myself.
Now all our charms are overthrown, and what strength we have is our own.
Start mobbing.
Well, this is
Tokyo.
I did it in Tokyo
back in
Tokyo.
You know,
this still can be an occasion,
though. It's like the car, you return to the car.
And like the that's probably the only reason why I would have something at the end. But that too becomes a form. I just feel that the sonnet was a superimposed form.
Not at the time. When Margaret, how about it, says go for broke, she means do all that you can do, that's all. And it doesn't matter, so to speak, what exactly you choose as context for what you do. I mean, it does matter very deeply. But the act is what is significant, I feel. Now, whether or not that can exist, of course, is what you mean. That's what I feel in the point of the book. Whether or not I can exist, you can exist.
You can do all you can, but still, it's just, well, except for me, at least,
I exist.
Look at that, which went before, and sort of,
well, that's like Robert's sense of the community. I mean, the sense that he reads in the words of, let's say, Virginia Woolf, that Shakespeare, you read, or Zukovsky's translation of Catullus, where he's reading with his sounds. Literally, he's trying to, not trying to, he is, as he feels this. He's reading with the sounds of the man who wrote, you know, as he translates. Yes, I think.
The point is to look at what Robert meant by extension. Really. Pardon?
You see, that was written, by the way, that was in a letter. So I should qualify that publicly. That was written in a letter to Olson. I can't remember just what I was talking about. He looked it up. And it was in the context of trying to understand how form could be more than an occasion of pattern, e.g., could be more than what the car was at that moment. For example, it was trying to understand how there could be a Rolls Royce as opposed to some set attitude toward what a car should be. Margaret just wrote on her paper here, why should? You know, why is the word should? And this was part of the feeling at that time. Why did it have to be, like Ben felt it? Why did it have to be this form or that form?
At the time when you wrote that, people were using the word form to mean a series of forms which you could look up in a book.
But what you said, form is never more than content, is good on the first hearing. But when you think about it, it may mean that then form can be less than content. And what one is really after is that form should equal content, you know, form equal sign content. That's why I added the word form reveals content, because form is no more than the revelation of content. Because
it implies all the context of what it's doing.
I say something that's still a breath. For me, when you dip it onto the page, you lose something.
Well, when I say equal, I don't mean it's the same as. It's not that, you're painting the apple and you want the painting to equal the apple, so you end up actually taking the apple and gluing it onto the canvas. That's not what I'm talking about. But if you say form is... What was it you said? Form is
only
content. Well, that can mean form is just a little bit of content, but what one is really after is to, as far as possible, get the whole content. Because you're not going to reveal the form that's in the content unless you have all of it. No, I didn't think they were arguing, actually.
I don't think, see, the whole question of the use of the words would never have arisen from the very beginning, like what is form, unless somebody had sneaked in some kind of form that had nothing to do with where we were a long time ago.
So, see, that's the very point. In that sense, I'm trying to figure out what form to give it, how do you express that?
It can't figure out what
it's
form
to give it.
Numerology, yeah? Figure out.
No, well, that's because I'm distracted, because when I started talking, he was saying, listen,
there's a lady I want to hear about. Yeah.
Yes. Before thought. Now, I was thinking about your son and going back into your history and thinking that the Petrarchan sonnet was the first one seen, and whether the English writers began to adopt it, they found that their language didn't begin comfortably with that Petrarchan sonnet, and they adapted their own.
Yeah.
And now, what would you say about this? Didn't they have their thought before form here? Didn't they have the thought first and then adapt to make certain adaptations?
They had their intention. I was thinking in the context of a house, for example. What one has is a reality of houses, is all the particular houses that one knows. And say you want to build a house. Well, you want a house in effect that you take the context of houses as you know them. And you say, well, it needs a roof and walls and windows, and senses of that order. It needs to, but then you get into that word should again. But you also want it to be your house specifically. And you want...
You don't get away from should by turning it into it needs to. And you don't get away from I value by saying it is valid. Passive twists here.
I know.
Terrible twists.
Can you help?
Like, no. Get away from should simply by
keeping your mouth
stepping down. Right out of it.
Well, it isn't. I think I lost something there because I wasn't really listening. But just going back to what the lady on the left said, okay, I should have been. The answer is simply no, because. And never, I just don't believe there ever, ever, ever is a poem which is really a poem where first the person has a thought and then they sit down and, I mean, I'm saying the same thing I've said two or three times already, but, and this is not because they shouldn't have a thought and then write a poem. The fact is that this just doesn't happen. The poem only arises in the process of writing a poem.
How about Wyatt? He says, they flee from me who sometime bid me seek. I'm sure he had that thought before he wrote the poem.
No, he has, what people have, they have thoughts and feelings which lead up to the beginning of the poem.
Yeah, yeah. They get there, really.
But it wasn't until he got those, exact words and that exact rhythm that he had it.
It didn't
happen to him until it was actually happening to him in the process of writing those words.
And I am curious.
There were antecedent things that brought him to the brink of the poem.
And I am curious as to how he lived.
Anyone from the opposite, say that the person who is not the writer of poems at all, how the hell they even get turned on to poems? And that's even a greater mystery to me. So
Dodd's in this book called The Greats and the Irrational, for example, there's a footnote, again, I said this earlier, where he simply cites the instance that people in heightened states or hysterical states or so-called irrational states speak in an order of verse, e.g. have a rhythmic coherence to their speech.
That's one idea.
That's an interesting sense. Just as going back to the whole context of
theology. What people do, you see, is an idea that...
No, they don't. There's no should in that.
No should.
Okay,
I'm there. Roy had a question. Roy,
isn't it a horrible habit?
Are you...
Of the pursuit of beauty in the husk that remains, perversion and mistake.
while a true form escapes in the wind,
well, see, this is,
views, not a
this is argument. This is argument. Is that Willie?
Yeah.
Well, remember he said to you, Alan, there are a lot of bastards out there?
Yes.
Yeah. He created a time. He lived in a reality that at times confronted him in this way, as a contest, as an argument with his own person. I mean, remember that meeting an old friend of his who said, and that was when I was younger, and I had this beautifully complete sense of William, but I don't think this man did me a service. He said, you forget that Williams is a very bitter man at times, that his contest personally, or that his contact with other people has at times been extraordinarily deep and extraordinarily complicated.
What bitter man said that?
You can imagine. Think who would say that.
Whom?
Edward Delmer.
Yeah, exactly. What bitter man said that?
Right. Who saw everything as that? Well, he's a good writer also.
Go on.
No,
I'm quite sure that unpredictable things occur in the painting.
Well, this is true. It doesn't matter. But then there is, Rubens, who did not originate the Baroque movement, but used the form, extended it, and is considered the culmination of Baroque art, right? Baroque art is Rubens in terms of painting. But he didn't originate that form. The form pre-existed.
Oh,
well, that's simply, you know, that list in Agassiz's reading about that there are innovators and people who build on the innovations, and then people who sort of imitate the people that build on them. A person who culminates a tradition belongs in the middle section. They didn't invent it, but they bring it to its highest point, say, you know, or its fullest point.
What do we mean by
the third example? What
do we mean by what?
What do we mean by form in the poem?
By form in the poem?
With reference to the poem. I was thinking
of
that.
I never understood what anybody meant by
that. The actual existence of the poem, the way that poem is, its presence.
But how do we know it's a poem? Because that was what this fellow asked me yesterday. It was a very heartbreaking question. I couldn't answer it. I mean, not this is a challenge.
Do we
what is a poem? If I remember where William says, I am a poet, I am, I read a poem. At 70, I remember walking in, there's two times I saw him where he said, Leonie Adams is this guy. Collected of poems just been published. And he said, if these are poems, what am I writing?
Yeah.
Not in any sense of struggle or argument with her, but he said, literally, if these are poems, what am I writing? What have I been writing?
There is no final objective answer to that question, any more than there is a final objective question to what is a man, what is life, you know. And it's a stupid kind of arrogance that thinks it must find an answer to this question.
Well, I think it's also like a madness that poses the question to begin with.
Well,
I mean, nobody ever cares about that anyway. When we're writing at this point, I don't think any of us care what a poem is or even what writing is.
I think we do. As this man yesterday cared. I care.
I know.
In another context,
I just want to write what I write, huh?
I know, but
if I start questioning it.
But equally, going back to the context of the very first time talking, where we were saying, I don't want to bother anyone. I think there was a light sense there. He didn't want to intrude upon people with something that wasn't an appropriate occasion.
Williams, you mean?
Well, Williams, yes, that's where I found him with him.
Yeah.
And this other man talking to him yesterday who didn't want me to say, yes, this is a poem A or something of that order. But he was literally stuck or hedged or boxed on the whole issue of whether or not what he was writing was of an order.
Yeah.
Exhibited, had within an order, It could be like Robert's sense of a call to order for the reader that could exhibit or had within it, I'm trying to think of words that are not elusive, that had within it inherently that which is recognized as poetry. And I never understood what poetry was, and Williams never understood what poetry was, and many people don't understand what poetry is. Understand, they feel it, they know it. But what measure exists to know, you see, that's...
One's own feeling.
Yeah.
This might go beyond the...
It's sociology, as I was saying. Yeah. It's the whole context of how to live. I mean, it goes... No, when you're writing, literally, as I think Denise would feel equally, you're not... You're literally unconscious of any kind of qualification of that order. You're not saying I'm... I remember my shock hearing Graves come down the stairs again, apropos of that, you know, coming out of his apartment saying I'm halfway through a poem for the New Yorker. You know, like, that was real. First of all, he was halfway through a poem, and secondly, it was for the New Yorker.
Oh, boy.
Well, maybe you
could
write New Yorker poems.
Apparently.
Well, read them, of course you can. You can see that they're written for the New Yorker.
And it was probably a poem that would satisfy other judgments. Boy.
Satisfy the New York Times.
Yeah.
It's
right.
Well, I'd say, what I'm confused today is that a lot of poems came in
from the and vice versa, and I my attention to a great deal of very polished form. Well, I think that's what the pop artists are trying to do. Manifest by using it. Yeah.
Daphne, do you know when you're writing a poem?
No.
Yeah. I mean, literally, there's no reason why. Yeah.
Usually, if I write anything any good, I assume that it isn't a poem and that it's not part of my career. Corpus, body of work, and nobody's going to look at it, and sometimes I just sort of put it away for years before finally either time and thoughts, people's thinking process, sociology comes around, fitting in so that I pull it out and say, well, you see, this fits in with what's supposed to be poetry. Or I finally say, oh, nothing's ever going to fit in, this is me, this is what I did, this is what happened, it's not me. Yeah.
Very fortunately, some people all of a sudden come over with a very vivid description,
just a straight shift of
passage.
Yeah.
You need a straight line,
and
there it is.
Yeah.
But
this
didn't happen. Why not?
Either you're not listening, or they're not making it. One or the other. You mean right now is this happening?
No, he means in a reading.
In a reading.
I think this question was important.
Well, yeah, I agree.
Oh, boy.
We all agree because we're all hung up on it all the time. We're all taught, you know, that it's supposed to be something. That it's supposed to be something in front of us that we can see before we did it. Just like what is life, or, you know, like what is marriage, or what or our own identity is handed to us in advance, hypnotized into our brains from advance. It takes years to get out of the hypnosis until the words disappear, or the categories disappear, and there we are.
Was sitting in his studio, as I remember the tale, this is for people who know, I understand, they don't get much art around here.
Oh, come on.
Anyway, Klein's story is that Klein was sitting in his studio one night after days of debauching and carrying on, talking and really thinking, dying, using himself, burning himself out. And he's looking at this blank canvas, and all of a sudden he just gets up and crosses the room with a piece of black paint and just destroys the canvas. He didn't invent anything. He destroyed it. He struck like a snake, like a man in despair who wants to kill himself, the forms, and all the rest of it, and die. Or, you know, he could have died then.
John, now we're dramatizing. Now we're in a play. I know, that's how we feel. I'm not putting
it. You don't like it, Robert.
No, I'm not putting it down.
I
say now we're...
Lots of room in this world.
No, but now we're living in the context of an interpretation.
We're going to be living in the context of everything, man.
I know. Right. I'm not putting...
I don't want to live in any context anymore.
I'm not putting...
What do you think the context is? Something that you find in a poem?
No,
not.
Charles once said to me...
It's something you find between two trees, perhaps.
What Alan said when he banged on the table, what Charles said to me a long time ago, he said, if you compete with other people in the sense that you try to exclude them or try to set up a structure in which they can only refer to you, you'll simply fight all your life. In other words, you'll put upon them some context of your memory is more valuable than theirs.
Yes, but you see, Klein didn't use exactly what you would call...
But you were using it.
What I do is, you know...
You
like,
said, first of all, that many people...
No, wait a minute, there's a misunderstanding here. What he was saying is, the way you were telling the story, all he was saying, not that Klein was wrong.
Not at all.
But not that you're...
I was under
implicit, not that you're implicitly declining your role.
Something that can happen now that is pertinent. The man has only been dead a number of
months. We all like Klein.
And he
left. We all love him.
We
all love you. It's all right. Everybody here says that. But all that he was saying was that the... that's why I'm trying to explain. Thank you, Robert.
The point is, the client did a thing a certain particular way, and I think the example of it should be told to someone so that they can find out a little bit about what the hell, how one of the events...
That's good. Okay, agreed. Right. But then what he was capping that with...
We don't need it anymore.
...was that, unless I was wrong, that the way you told it presented it as sort of in a play, almost.
I hope so. God damn it, I pray that it did.
Well, but we were also not in the play anymore.
John,
I'm
I don't care what it sounded like, as long as it maybe went to Jesse, or got the message.
Well, he probably got the message. He got the message. The function was fulfilled, because he did get the message. He did get the message.
Good, there you go. You all boosted it for me. Wow.
I'll
come to your theater every time.
Jack Blossom.
There's another play going on.
Let's return this to something.
Yeah. Let's stop for a
second. Let's not waste time.
By the way, Bill, have you met John Keith? John Keith.
That's not mine.
We like each other.
Well, Daphne, for example, cracked real to race ray, Latin meaning thing. You know? And so when we speak of real people, we mean thing, something that has that substantiality for it. That was a relief to know that that's what real meant. Back to the same old smiling guy.
It's not the person who asked me that I read the poem yesterday, but it asked me for an evaluation. He knows that there are no criteria by which you can judge, except that there are very vague interests of your own. And yet he's arguing he wants a value judgment to be passed. I don't think I can
perceive
a value judgment.
There's
no criteria by which to
give
it. No. Well, actually, Robert didn't give him that was a difficulty. So Robert gave him Robert's value judgment. Robert gave him, in that scene, value judgments in the terminology that he wanted, but then it all broke down because they knew they weren't talking about it. It was just right. But what it was that Robert, like, responded to the poem, actually, or responded to the writing, or thought the writing was real, and that was actually what the young poet wanted. not value or real or anything, just he wanted Robert. He wanted a relation with Robert, which he got through the poem. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you got having a relation with him.
Yes, I like the poem.
So finally, the two of them were, they had not yet even conversed. Or the young kid was scared of Robert, thought Robert was shooting or something.
About writing, about how you write for a while, and then there's that all the time, it would be very handy
I wouldn't have made this insistence, perhaps, upon this point, except that I remember the time I was in college in the 40s, when the New Critics were dominant.
They were, of course.
And they defined, I'm not saying this critically of them, so to speak, but I remember it was a time in which, say, Whitman was disregarded as a poet, but his poems, rather, literally, were not read. It was also a time when The Bridge by Hart Crane was disregarded because it was considered to be a form of failure. And I remember even then, in this awkwardness, trying to understand how something that I felt could be a failure. I mean that very simply. If I read The Bridge, and if it moved me, and if I found in a context for feeling, literally, if I felt what was said to me in it, then how could it be a failure? Then they would explain to me, they being the various instructors, let's say, or English teachers who would come to this occasion, and show me how the purpose of the poem as it was extricable from the actual poem had not been satisfied by the poem as it was actual. And then I get awfully lost in this dichotomy.
That was a time when Williams was considered, what
does
he say?
A paranoid mumbler. I think it's Frederick, is it Bennett? Yeah, Bennett in a review in the Hudson Review. A long review of his work. I was very surprised to see this is literary politics, which has not much to do with what we're talking about. But what it was
all those people gathering up the authority unto themselves and saying, we are the authority and nobody else got it unless they satisfy our conditions of existence.
Literary politics has a great deal to do.
Well, with one's life, it has a lot to do with
it. Not only life. After all, doesn't literary politics take in something in the broad field of what you call
it? It seems like. For example, there's a man at the University of California, at Berkeley, and Robert told me this, every time this friend of Robert's, Robin Blazer, who's a librarian, would put Zukovsky's books on the order slips, this man would cross them off. So consequently,